It's that time of the year when lists are everywhere. The big fella's been checking his naughty and nice list, and if your family's anything like ours, then there were present lists, card lists, shopping lists, meal plans. Or maybe that's just my family. My wife is a qualified pilot too, and pilots love checklists. While thinking about the looming deadline for this episode, I stumbled upon my wife's meticulous plans for our Christmas celebrations. Every detail from wake up to the end of the Christmas feast was mapped out, orchestrated, and carefully ticked off as the day progressed. There's a reason pilots love checklists. They work. They may seem mundane, but checklists ensure smooth workload management, not just at Christmas time, but any occasion where time or safety criticality would punish omissions or mistakes. Hello everybody, I'm Phil Wilkes. Welcome aboard the Like a Pilot podcast, where we unveil the soft skills pilots utilize every time they strap into those high-speed aluminium and carbon fiber giants we call airliners. This show is your ticket to understanding the how and why behind what makes aviation one of the safest modes of travel. So, it's time to fasten your seatbelts and join me now as we embark on a journey through the skies where pilot skills become the blueprints for high performance in any field. Grab your pen and paper or your digital to-do list app, because in this episode, we're diving deep into the world of checklists. Different types and approaches to checklists, exploring their power, their limitations, best practice for checklist design, and how they can be secret weapons in achieving goals or conquering everyday tasks. So stay tuned for a journey into the world of checklists, where crossing off items becomes a satisfying victory, and every tick is a step toward a more accomplished you. Before we dive in, let's define the scope of our exploration. A checklist is any structured list of tasks, actions, or points to be completed, verified, or achieved. Often, these items are sequenced either in an order that they need to be done or based on their importance. Checklists serve as a powerful tool for organizing tasks and ensuring they are done correctly and reliably, preventing the omission of crucial steps. Checklists are versatile tools used in various settings. While we'll certainly be looking at how pilots use checklists, they're certainly not the sole preserve of the aviation industry. We've already established that checklists can be utilized for personal productivity, but beyond that, they are used in many professional settings. The construction industry uses checklists to ensure safety compliance and quality control on construction sites. Project managers use checklists to help break down complex projects into manageable tasks and to track progress. And in healthcare, surgical checklists have been shown to reduce surgical complications and improve patient outcomes. Atul Gawande, a Harvard-trained surgeon, led a World Health Organization initiative to reduce deaths during surgery. As part of their research, they looked at what other high-risk industries did to improve safety beyond the use of technology and training. This led them down the path of consulting with the lead safety engineer at Boeing to specifically look at the use of checklists in aviation. The project led to the development of a surgical safety checklist. When this checklist was implemented in 8 hospitals around the world, complication rates in surgery were reduced by 35%. And death rates fell by 47%, not to mention the millions of dollars saved. Checklists work. The effectiveness of checklists lies in their ability to enhance organization, reduce errors, and provide a visual guide for completing tasks or achieving goals. Quoting Atul Gawande, checklists are tools to make experts better. So, if the World Health Organization thought there was a benefit investigating the use of checklists in the aviation industry, how exactly do pilots use checklists? Broadly speaking, aviation checklists are broken into 2 main categories: those covering normal procedures and those covering abnormal or emergency procedures. Checklists that cover normal procedures serve as confirmation of the most critical actions of a procedural pattern or flow that precedes them, and tend to capture non-completion of safety-critical items only. As an example, the before start checklist on an A380 covers only 10 items, three of which are actually monitored by the aircraft systems themselves and need only be addressed if they appear as incomplete on an electronic checklist. Compare this to the over 120 procedural items the two operating pilots of the A380 will have completed prior to the completion of the before start checklist. Many of the action items in themselves involve multiple steps of a procedure. As an aid to memory, the procedural items follow a sequence flow around the flight deck. Checklists that follow on from a series of procedures act as a last line of defense, and are therefore sequenced into procedural flows at safety critical junctures. In a TED talk discussing the World Health Organization project he led, Atul Gawande identified these safety critical junctures as pause points, and noted that they are clearly delineated by titles that identify the pause points. For example, before takeoff checklist, approach checklist, landing checklist. He further identified the items being checked as pillar items. Adjacent to normal procedures and their accompanying checklists are supplementary procedures. These are procedures that exist for operations that supplement normal procedures but aren't actioned on every flight. Procedures, for example, that cover operations in adverse weather, such as snow and ice. As they cover non-routine procedures, they are almost never committed to memory. The checklists that cover these items are therefore also different. In fact, the checklist itself is procedural, serving as a guide or an algorithm, a to-do list. Task sharing wise, generally, one pilot will read the checklist while the other pilot completes the action items. Not surprisingly, they are therefore known as procedural checklist or as read and do checklists. Checklists for abnormal and emergency situations are almost always procedural checklists. By their nature, they are for use in an emergency and therefore may never be seen outside of training over the length of a pilot's career. Note that I said almost entirely. There are occasions where the time criticality of an emergency means that there is no time for a considered decision-making process. In episode 2, we considered that events may occur where there is no time for other than decision-making based on readily identified cues. In a 2005 report, NASA recognized that some situations unfold so quickly that pilots should concentrate on flying the aircraft to a landing, and that there may be no time to consult a checklist. For these times, aircraft manufacturers will have outlined a clear set of procedures that must be actioned from memory immediately when these events present themselves. Depending on your manufacturer of choice, these are known as boxed, bold-faced, recall, or memory items. Beyond memory checklists, the manufacturers may also publish memory procedures. To ensure recall when the relevant cues are triggered, pilots will use mental imagery, mnemonics, and flow patterns to embed these checklists and procedures. So, how good are checklists? We already looked at some impressive statistics from the surgical settings, but how useful are they in aviation? As the co-author of Performance Pilot, a book on optimizing performance for pilots, I was invited to be the guest on a podcast where we discuss tools pilots used that may be transferable to investors. I was asked if I could think of a time that disaster was averted by checklist or other systematic flight preparation processes. This was a really tough question to answer, as the question really speaks to the entire reason for checklists, making sure that safety critical items aren't missed. But are all checklists good? Can the use of checklists ever result in a bad outcome? On the 2nd of September 1998, a seemingly innocuous smoke event on board a Swissair flight rapidly degenerated into a severe in-flight fire, leading to a loss of all on board. In the Transport Safety Board of Canada investigation, it was determined that the relevant checklist would have taken 20 to 30 minutes to action. Swissair Flight 111 had crashed a short 17 minutes after smoke was first detected. In late 2004, the Flight Safety Foundation commenced an initiative that resulted in a report containing a template that standardized optimal crew response to a smoke, fire, or fumes event, including considerations for immediate landing. Since its publication, most aircraft manufacturers have revised their checklist to conform to the template. Unless the source of smoke is immediately identifiable, a diversion is initiated before any fault finding is commenced. Checklist design was also a factor raised in the investigation of an accident we looked at in Episode 2. In January 2009, US Airways Flight 1549, an Airbus A320, ditched into the Hudson River after hitting geese and losing all engine power while climbing on departure from New York's LaGuardia Airport. As Captain Sully Sullenberger flew the aircraft, First Officer Jeff Skolls actioned the engine dual failure checklist. The content and format of this checklist, as published at the time of the accident, was the result of amendments made by Airbus as part of their continuing improvement process. Acting on usage reports by pilots, they had introduced branches or gates into the checklist based on a determination of whether fuel remained, that is, whether the engine could be restarted or not, and they'd consolidated previously separate checklists to include forced landing and ditching procedures. Just like in the Swissair Flight 111 case, the downside to this consolidated checklist was its length. Furthermore, in their investigation into the ditching, the NTSB found that Airbus had designed the checklist based on the highest probability in time of exposure that a dual engine failure would occur. Specifically, it was designed around failures above 20,000 feet. US Airways 1549 hit the flock of geese below 3,000 feet. The NTSB report noted that it would have been unreasonable to expect pilots to be able to properly diagnose such a complex failure given the presented information and time criticality. Indeed, as the crew worked through the part of the checklist covering an engine restart, there was no trigger to move forward in the checklist to prepare for a ditching. Furthermore, the crew had had to improvise their approach to the checklist designed for higher altitude use. The checklist called for an airspeed of 300 knots to facilitate engine relight, well above their climb speed at the time they impacted the geese. The only way they could have achieved this would have been by pointing the nose downhill to accelerate, sacrificing altitude, a commodity they just didn't have to spare. Fortunately, both crew members were familiar with the context of the checklist and did complete some steps from memory that would otherwise have taken extra time to work towards or would have not been reached. These steps ultimately improved aspects of the outcome. In their 2005 report previously mentioned, NASA noted that checklists can't be designed for all emergencies, but where they are, they should cover all phases of flight. It is also worth noting that, at the time of the investigation of US Airways 1549, Airbus indicated that they hadn't considered developing a dual engine failure checklist for low altitude. They have now. The back of the Airbus quick reference handbooks for their twin engine products now include checklists for emergency landing, all engine failure, covering ditching or forced landing when the aircraft is unable to maintain altitude following a loss of thrust near the ground. At least at the airline I fly at, these are colloquially known as the Sully checklists. Checklists covering the loss of thrust on all engines on Airbus aircraft also now have a branch waypoint at an altitude of 10,000 feet, where the emphasis of the checklist moves away from attempting to relight the engines and towards preparing for a forced landing or ditching. Okay, so checklists are great, but how can you use them in your daily life? Pilots love checklists. Beyond the checklists provided by the manufacturers and our employer, pilots often have their own checklist. We invent checklists for what to consider for a diversion, what information to include in briefings. I'm a pilot, so of course, I love checklists too. One of my favourites, taught to me by a friend, is a checklist used as a gross error check before closing doors and removing the error bridge for departure. It comes complete with its own easy-to-remember mnemonic, LEFT. I even have a checklist for what to pack for a 9-day London trip in winter. Seriously, not much fun to be over 20 hours flying time from home and realise you didn't pack enough uniforms. And this wasn't even an original idea. When I was working as a casual ski instructor, I had a checklist for packing for the snow. And when I was racing cars, I had checklists for preparing the car to race, packing for the races, and setting the car up between races. A lot of these checklists were revised to ensure that errors made previously would not be repeated. As I mentioned in the previous episode, during the worst of the COVID pandemic, like most airline pilots worldwide, I was presented with the opportunity to make alternative employment arrangements. I took up a public service management role in the state in which I live and had the opportunity to work with managers from various backgrounds. That being said, a lot of them were from the aviation industry, particularly cabin managers. Working as part of our state's response to the pandemic, not only were all of us new to the public service, but our roles themselves were new. There were basic fundamentals in place as to what our roles involved and why we were there, but not a lot else from a procedural basis. Perhaps not surprisingly, for a bunch of aviation professionals, we immediately set about codifying our own local procedures and writing checklists for everything, literally everything. We had checklists for our normal procedures, our contingency procedures, what each manager would do at various times on a shift, as well as weekly and monthly checklists, checklists for handovers and takeovers. These checklists served as the basis for ensuring everything got done and in the time frames with which they were expected. We shared our checklist in shared computer directories and made amendments when improvements or shortcomings in process became evident. Can you think of situations in your life where you could use a checklist? Do you need a fire plan because you live in a rural area? Are there jobs that you often do that are complex and need to be worked through systematically? Do you edit video or audio? Design classes, prepare paperwork that needs to be signed off. Checklists are also great for tracking daily accountability for personal development goals. New Year's resolutions in hand, what if the secret to achieving those resolutions lies not in grand pronouncements, but in the humble checklist? Research has shown that we have a 42% higher chance of achieving goals if they are written down. Perhaps the key to success isn't just setting goals, but meticulously planning the steps that will get us there. Breaking a goal down into steps that we can check off on a checklist helps us in this regard. It holds us accountable and can even prevent procrastination. To quote personal development expert Tony Robbins, "What gets checked gets done." So, if Swiss Air 111 and US Airways 1549 indicate the design of checklists can be flawed, surely there are best practices we can lean on when designing our own checklists to use in our everyday work and personal lives. Borrowing from the findings of these reports, as well as NASA's 2005 report into checklist design, I believe the essence of designing a functional checklist must include the following considerations. Structure. To avoid getting stuck in an inappropriate checklist or portion thereof, there should be opt-in and opt-out points, or gates, pillar points. Organisation. the order of the checklist steps, either procedurally or in order of criticality. Completeness. A checklist should include all routine steps that may be missed under stress as reminders. Anyone who has ever struggled with plans for flat-packed furniture will understand the issue with incomplete checklists. The wording. It should be carefully considered to ensure it's unambiguous, and this includes the checklist title. Workload. The checklist should consider the situation under which it's to be used. It shouldn't increase the mental workload of the user. In particular, as attention narrows in an emergency due to increased workload and stress, checklists for use during emergency or time-critical situations should minimize memory load. Ease of use. Users may lose their place if a checklist requires flipping forwards and backwards or between checklists. Checklists can't be too long. While they should not be reliant on memory or ambiguous, wherever possible, shorter is better. And completion time. Longer checklists are prone to interruption. Again, wherever possible, shorter is better. Well-written checklist at hand, this prompts another question. How can we maximize the effectiveness of checklists? That is, how do we best use a checklist? Firstly, I would say the most important aspect to using a checklist is in the name itself. Checklist. A checklist will not serve its purpose if it is given lip service. What do I mean by this? Let me explain by way of example. When I was on pilot course in the Air Force, during takeoff and go rounds, when we were asking the most of the single jet engine propelling us away from the ground, our checklist required a check of the engine oil temperatures and pressures being in normal operating bands. Oil temperatures and pressures in the green being the call. They almost certainly would be, but in early days, to ensure we were actually checking and not just reciting the usual mouth music, our instructors would make us call the actual parameters. In later sorties, by which time we were allowed to just call in the green, they would occasionally pull a circuit breaker for the engine instruments just to make sure we were actually checking. In Japan, the railways enjoy an enviable safety record. Since the first Shinkansen service in 1964, over 10 billion passengers have travelled without a single passenger fatality from derailment or collision. Even though they work alone, whenever a driver or conductor need confirmation of a safety critical item has been actioned, the item of concern is deliberately focused on, pointed at, and its actual status verbalised. The Japanese call this shisakanko, pointing and calling. Unless the checklist is being used as a procedural checklist, systematic processes and practices before resorting to a checklist mean that errors are often captured before the checklist serves its vital role as being used as a last line of defense. If you are constantly needing your checklist to capture errors, then you need to take a closer look at your procedural flows, resource management, and threat and error management. To improve their processes, pilots will often link procedural items together. When you do this next. To improve flows, in our book Performance Pilot, we suggest that pilots critically self-debrief every flight, looking at what they could do better next time, not in negative don't do this terms, but instead positively framed, thinking about the behaviours they want to repeat. This is much harder, but ultimately a better outcome from a performance coaching perspective. It can also help colour writing of checklists. So that's it, folks. I hope you've enjoyed our investigation into how pilots use checklists. Hopefully now you've fired up your creative juices to figure out where you may be able to use them in your own life, along with some considerations to ponder as you create effective and well-written checklists. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Like a Pilot podcast. For more information, check out the show notes at philwilks.com/podcast. The Like a Pilot podcast is written and produced by me, Phil Wilkes. If you'd like to support the Like a Pilot podcast, our Patreon page is available at patreon.com/likeapilot. And if you've liked the show, please remember to rate, share, and review.